If you have been coming to Holden or have heard about the daily format, you also know that this is the time for the Bible study. This is the biblical hour. So it is a biblical study on that theme. I'm also going to define think with. I don't think that's self-evident. E.F. Schumacher wrote a book, Small is Beautiful. And that was the first time I had seen a distinction made between a think with and a think about. And I'd like to, I'm sure that you have your own way of saying that, but it's not a bad way to say it. And I'd like to give you some explanation of why I'm using this as the biblical study approach this morning. When we come to a problem, when we come to family finances or budget, when you come to making choices, life's work, when you have political leanings, when you talk about the arms race tonight, when you talk about inclusive or exclusive language, you will think about today, you will think about hundreds of things. When you come to those things, you bring with you some assumptions, values, beliefs that you don't stir up very often. They are settled. They are the things you think with. Do you feel the difference? If you had to start this morning thinking about everything, you wouldn't be here yet. You wouldn't have tied your shoes yet or been able to function or choose the clothes you were going to wear or anything else. Some things are settled. Now, I'm on fairly minor things at this point. Let me illustrate that a couple ways. William Stringfellow said, I want to see my country biblically. I don't want to see my Bible Americanly. He was choosing a theological, biblical think with by which he then judged other things, not the other way around. And I believe that that's a very legitimate, in fact necessary, approach when we come to the Scriptures. We tend to think of our Bible Americanly, or of our Bible middle classly, or of our Bible republicanly, or democratically, or socialistly, or capitalistly, instead of the Bible being the touchstone and all of these other isms and things being under the scrutiny of the Scriptures. Let me give you a couple illustrations. Today we're talking about sufficiency, the idea of enough, as a basic assumption when the Scripture talks about a lot of other things. For instance, the Scriptures promise us life abundantly. I believe that's true. I believe that's God's promise. But if we bring the present idea from Madison Avenue of what abundance is and read that into the promise, God said we would have life abundant. Can you image what your house looks like and your garage and your driveway and your marina and just keep going? That would be to see the Bible promise Madison Avonlea, or I, let's stop that. I can't do those fast enough, and they're getting bad. If, on the other hand, when the Scriptures talk about abundance, the think with is sufficient, enough, then I think that promise is true, that God supplies our needs and supplies them abundantly. Another way to say that, the Scriptures promise God supplies your needs. We are moving to where we also think God must supply our greeds. That's never been a promise. Another illustration. Scripture says that when God gives its full measure, shaken down, can you picture the basket? Shaken down and overflowing. Wes Preeb popcorn. Did you ever see him? Shake it down and put you a little bit more. That's a scriptural popcorn bag. But we dare not determine from our values how big the basket is. Our culture tends to say if your basket is full and shaken down, Don't sing an alleluia, a te deum, and start giving things away. Get a bigger basket. And that has never been God's promise. And more importantly, I hope by coffee break we will have some sense, and it also is not the path to freedom, fullness, contentment, joy, the idea of insatiable appetites equals never being content. Insatiable appetites, you just build into it, I am never full. And I think that that means that we are less joyful and our life is less abundant than God meant it to be. I want to move on to the biblical material, but I want you to have some, I don't want this to be a surprise or a gimmick. I think it's a good way to say it, but I want to make sure that that's clear. The assumption this morning is to test the premise. When Scripture talks about our life, about God's gifts, about what it means to be full, about what it means to be free, within the Scriptures, under the Scriptures, there is the assumption that fullness and abundance and all of those things mean enough, sufficient. Okay? It helps if you nod when you mean when I say, then I know I can go on. If you just sit and look at me, I just say it over and over and over and over. Okay. Thank you, Darius.
You want an
all,
amen?
All preachers should have an amen corner. I put one scripture on the board. Not that it's a proof passage, but that it's characteristic. It's a paradigm. You know, do you ever use that word? It's the kind of model which is more than a model and becomes the form or the test stone for other things. It's the cluster of thinkwits. If you've done value clarification, it's some of the prime values. I'm going to read that to you. If you have your scriptures, open it. Proverbs 38 and 9. In fact, I think you start with the second half of verse 8. Yes. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is needful for me, lest I be full and deny thee and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of my God. Give me neither poverty. There's no freedom in that. There is no fullness in that. It dehumanizes. But the surprise, I think, in our culture is also give me not riches. There's no fullness or freedom in that either. Lest I think that I'm the Lord, or lest I have more than enough. The lack of freedom of having more than enough is also present in the scriptures. So kind of keep that in mind, and let's go through some other scriptures. And I probably won't take the time to look them all up, but if you're the kind of person who likes to come back and review this, I'll cite the instance as often as I can. In the accounts in Genesis, the creation accounts, I think those are familiar to you, 6 days were enough. And on the seventh, take a day off. Take a day of rest. Our Jewish friends, the scholars who live in the Old Testament, and I wish all of us did that more, but the people who understand Judaism, Abraham Heschel, for instance, a delightful writer, and he's dead now, but a contemporary of ours from few years back, used to walk with Reinhold Niebuhr because he was at the Jewish seminary right across the street from Union Seminary and Columbia University. He said, if you want to find grace in the Old Testament, he spent a lot of time with Protestants and Christians, and they were always wondering whether the Jewish religion had grace. He would say, if you want to find grace in the Old Testament, study the Sabbath. The Sabbath says life will not end and the world will not end if you take a day off. Always keeps you from this kind of arrogance that we're the ones holding everything together. The Sabbath was meant to be that graceful nonchalance. Quick quiz to make sure you're still there. Monday morning, you have to every once in a while give a quick quiz. Circumcision was on what day? Eighth day. You know why? To make sure that never a Jewish boy baby, never, it was a masculine society then, never would be circumcised before he had experienced at least one Sabbath. It was on the sixth day he might have missed the Sabbath. The Sabbath came before the circumcision. That's true. The importance of that grace in the Old Testament. 6 days shall you labor. Enough is enough. Now take a day off. And remember, of all the times Jesus brought the gospel into that, when we get picky about that, when we think that this, that was somehow to be legalistic instead of a gift to us, we miss the understanding of sufficiency, of enough is enough. Just think of our culture. Psychiatrists have two terms, vacationitis and Sundayitis. There are some people on their day off who get a headache every time. There are some people who cannot take the absence of work, who cannot rest, literally. The average length, the average life expectancy at the present time in the United States of the American male after retirement is 8 months. Our worth, and we're moving into where that's male and female statistic, part of the movement of equality is that you're going to get all of the hypertension and neurosis and tension-related diseases that we have chosen for ourselves as males. We are so associated with work. Our worth is so associated with our being part of a productive system that come retirement, we are literally worthless. And so lots of people die quickly. That's one of the places, I think, where the church with a Sabbath can give us some idea of our worth not being connected with our being part of a productive system. Yes, very high. Thank you, Oscar. Okay, look also in the listing of the Sabbath. When the Ten Commandments are repeated again in Exodus 23, for instance, one of the reasons for the day off is so that your oxen also get a break. In the Old Testament, there is a shalom vision that includes all of creation, and the animals are always brought into that. I think that that's part of the Old Testament understanding of enough is enough, too. How about in the Ten Commandments, the emphasis against covetousness? And do you remember how often it's equated with idolatry? Or how it's one of the sins that really gets us away from an understanding of God as the giver of every good and perfect gift, and us as the receiver, and how it builds in the kind of intention of insatiable appetite. The Old Testament has some strong sections on that. Well, if you're already in Proverbs, stay in Proverbs 30 and look at 15. The leech has two daughters. Give, give, they cry. Three things are never satisfied. Four never say enough. Sheol, the barren womb, the earth ever thirsty for water, and the fire which never says enough. The idea of insatiable appetites. I used to carry around clippings to try to visualize this, but I've kind of lost them in my years of traveling. There was a restaurant in Denver that had a half-page ad of a salad bowl that was overflowing, and it said, the one restaurant in Denver where enough is never enough. They guaranteed that they would give you so much food that we had to throw some away. That you just build in that understanding that you felt you got cheated if you got enough, so that the restaurant said that they would give you more than enough. The picture of a kind of insatiable appetite. You remember some of the laws in the Old Testament, in Deuteronomy? I remember reading them years ago and wondered why they made it into the Bible. Is that a funny way to put it? Never beat the olive branch twice. Did you know that was in the Bible? Have you ever broken that law? Do you see the difference between coming and saying, if we're going to be Bible people, let's make sure none of our members ever beat the olive branch twice, kind of misses the point. What's the assumption behind that? Move into the assumption behind that. That's the way you get to be biblical people. We, for too long, have thought Bible studies were learning what the Bible says instead of being invited to see the way the Bible sees. That's when you're biblical people, not when you can memorize and spout it, but when it begins to shape your life. What's behind never beat the olive branch twice? is this group going to be afraid of moving in to fill in the blank answers because you might have the wrong? Try it. What do you think it means? Get enough olives the first time? Take that. What? Somebody else said something. The peak. Okay, you'll get the ones that are really ready for harvest, and you won't start worrying about a little extra profit today. It'll be a better weight of harvest. There's two more things that were part of the Old Testament that are not part of our culture now.
Leave some for the poor.
It was the welfare system. So was gleaning. And this one, we're just not enough St. Francis.
The birds.
Yeah. Don't take every bit the birds. One of the first times in my life I moved into a culture that understood sufficiency in a really beautiful way was when Mary and I and our family moved to West Virginia from Washington, D.C. I'd never lived on a farm. We knew nothing about farming. In fact, there were so many people. We moved from D.C. in those years of the 60s when, you know, we were close to the seat of power, and senators came to our house and people would say, "Why did you move to West Virginia? Like, what did you do by moving out there?" And I got asked that so often that I finally came up with an answer. I said, "We moved to an area so poor, no TV, 52 miles from a theater. We moved to an area, we gave our neighbors enough laughs for the next 10 years. They deserved a laugh, and no one laughed more than those people on the party line about the last thing the Shrams did. I mean, it was... But anyway... First year we planted a garden. The most successful thing was zucchinis. Did we have zucchinis? But early on, the groundhogs came. And they would eat the stuff before it grew, and they would eat the stuff while it grew. And so I was down the road getting my car worked on by a neighbor. And his name was Cleveland Smith, but his nickname was Clink. And I said, "Clink, we have groundhogs coming into the garden." He said, "Indeed, everyone does." I said, "You mean you have that problem too?" "Indeed, I do." I said, "Have you solved it?" He said, "I plan enough for us and for them." I think the kind of postscript he said, "They have to eat too." I had not gotten to that. I would have to come up with some theological term. That shalom vision, Clink had no theological term for it. He just kind of lived with an understanding that that was part of God's creation too. All right. That seems to me to permeate the Old Testament in lots of those gleaning olive branch stories. Another one: never take both the baby bird and the mother. That's the law, Deuteronomy. What's it getting at?
You would exterminate the extinction.
The extinction, hunting to extinction, a whole species of animals, is unthought of in the biblical understanding of enough is enough and a vision that includes all of creation. To think that we as the human race, who are now the hunters, have the right for either maximizing our profit or eliminating what we call as a problem, to hunt to extinction is not part of the think with of the Old Testament. Those are the kinds of stories that we're talking about. Now let's get into something that's maybe more where we are than, I don't know, maybe some of you are in the whales. You know, there's a whole group that's trying to save the whales. Maybe that is part of some of you here, and we can talk about it. How about charging interest when you have more money than you need and someone else has less than they need and you make money off of your surplus and their scarcity? Does the Bible say anything about that? Yeah, lots. Lots. I think within the next 20 or 30 years, it will be again a forum topic at Holden Village. Right now, that would not fly. No one would come on the old issue of usury. That's what it was called, the charging of interest. I think we may get to that day again, on the morality of making money when you have more than enough and someone else does not have enough. Why is it not a forum topic today? For a lot of years, a system of interest charging. That's in the essence of the system of capitalism that we've had, and it has brought us a lot of growth and good development, and so we never question that. We have a hard time moving into the biblical conversation in regard to money and making money off it. In other words, I don't think you will get very far in your congregation, if it includes the president of the local savings and loan, raising this as a deep moral issue today in the United States. Again, what was the assumption behind it? If abundance is for you to have enough, then their system just could not imagine that you built a whole system on the necessity of having more than you need, because more than you need is what made the whole system work. It's just foreign to the pages of the Old Testament. We do get a good white knuckle forum when we talk about, can you be a Christian and a capitalist, or can you be a Christian and a socialist? That's one of the topics still that bubbles things up at Holden. If I read the Old Testament correctly, some year when you got more than enough, just imagine that, more than you needed. If God was that abundant and gracious, don't add to that by making money off some poor person that didn't have enough. So Exodus 22:25, if you advance money to any poor among my people, you shall not act like a money lender, you must not exact interest in advance. Ezekiel 18:16. You can mark those if you want, though. I'm not going to take the time to look them all up. There was high praise for the one who gives bread to the hungry and clothes to those who have none. He never lends, either at discount or at interest. If you're interested historically, Nicaea, the Council of Nicaea, had it as a major agenda item. Their conclusion was priests should not charge interest. Lay people can. Priests should not. Council of Carthage objected even to lay persons who wanted to live out an understanding of followers of the way and the way of Jesus Christ should not charge interest. Luther, when he wrote, basically condemned the charging of interest. All right. What I'm saying is the reason that was part of the Old Testament understanding of a moral issue, of a faith issue for God's people, was there was a think with of enough is enough, of sufficiency. So when you had more than enough, you really tried to figure out what you did with that in order to be generous and to understand that all that we have is God's gift. I want you to turn to Leviticus 25, because we're going to stay in that for just a little bit. It's a little bit cumbersome reading. Leviticus and all of the details of the law are probably not your favorite morning meditation biblically, right? It's like saying, I'm going to read the Bible, and you start with the book of Numbers. Start somewhere else. Let that be a little down the line. It's not very inspiring. What is Leviticus 25? I want to give you a little past history. The American Lutheran Church was formed in 1960. I was a parish pastor in Annandale, Virginia. From headquarters has a way of getting ideas and packaging them. Have you ever noticed? Have you ever been on a congregational committee and these handy-dandy packets come at you? This one was a thing that included a plastic ram's horn. And it said we were to blow that on a particular Sunday and declare Jubilee Year as celebration for the formation of the American Lutheran Church. Well, I wanted to be faithful. I couldn't get a peep out of the thing. I found a trumpet player who couldn't play it, so we didn't blow it that morning. I'm being facetious about headquarters. I'm not anti-headquarters. I am anti those little gimmicks. What I did not do was look up Jubilee Year. If I had declared that Sunday morning in Annandale, Virginia in 1960 as Jubilee Year, they'd have run me out. This is some of the most radical social legislation in the Old Testament. In fact, when our country celebrated its 200th birthday, and there was the official celebration, then there was the kind of counterculture group called the People's Bicentennial. Did you ever get any of those things? Arthur Waskow in Washington, D.C. at the Institute of Policy Studies said, we don't need some leftist political group telling us how to celebrate a kind of counterculture bicentennial. In the Jewish Christian tradition, all we should do is declare Jubilee year. So that's much more radical than this stuff coming out of a kind of leftist political slant. Jubilee year had four things that happened. I want to tell you about them. You look up Leviticus 25, and you also need to get one of them clarified from Deuteronomy 15. And all I'm doing is telling you, you can sort them out if you read this chapter. Jubilee year is 7 times 7. Old Testament has an understanding of Sabbath year. I already told you. If you want to find grace in the Old Testament, look for the Sabbath. So the seventh year was a year of rest. 7 times 7. You know, the Jewish people like to intensify. So 10 times 10 times 10, 1,000 years, is completeness, thrice intensified. People who read Revelation and miss that and think it's actually 1,000 years, miss the intent of Hebrew literature and Hebrew counting. 7 times 7. On Jubilee year, it was a special Sabbath time, and four things happened. The land lay fallow. What was the assumption behind that? Enough is enough. Give the land a break, too. I'm not even sure with what we've learned today about farming techniques that the best thing for the land is necessarily to leave it lie fallow, but the way we would keep that is not plant and eliminate all the hedgerows, not deplete the soil for the sake of maximizing this year's profits. In Iowa today, for every bushel of corn, we lose 2 bushels of topsoil. That's not building toward a sustainable society. It's poor stewardship. The understanding of letting the land lie fallow on the seventh year and the 7 times 7 year was care of the earth. All prisoners were to be released. Try that in your... we even tried to have a halfway house in our neighborhood in Washington, D.C. Oh my, will that bring the neighbors out? And you'll find out where people stand on that issue. Having them live right here, you know, just, can you imagine all... The only thing that really carried the day for some of those was some of the prisoners came and said, look, if the house is here, the word will spread. Don't you rob a store within 3 blocks of here or we'll get blamed. You'll have the safest... That brought a few of them around. when Christian love didn't work, that one was very helpful. All right. Prisoners are released. Look in these chapters, most of them were in debtor's prison, so it was an economic factor. All debts are canceled. Try that one. The idea behind Jubilee year is if you let a system go and you let more and more power and money get in the hands of fewer and fewer people, you're going to have oppression. You've read the books. How many corporations now control 80% of the funds in the country or in the world? How many billionaires or millionaires are there? The separation between rich and poor, a system tends to build that way. The Old Testament had a way every 50 years you leveled it. The last one. Oh, by the way, the reason that there was difficulty in borrowing money on the 46th, 7th, 8th, 9th, can you imagine? On the 48th year, say, could you lend me a couple thousand? And the next year it was going to be canceled. They had to come up with ways for the economic system not to collapse. You read some of the Jewish, there were ways in which you found a good lawyer and you had a prusbul, which kind of eliminated that year. It held it in abeyance, and then you collected it back the next year or something. They had all kinds of trouble trying to get around the understanding of Jubilee year. The last one was, if land had changed from one family to another within that 50 years, and usually again that was because you had gone bankrupt, it went back to the previous family. So that you cut down these larger and larger conglomerations of land. Those are the four provisions of Jubilee. Once more, and I've said this 3 or 4 times, I'm not sure that what it means to be faithful is to bring those four provisions from a long ago, rural, different atmosphere, different economic system, and suddenly try to institute them legally in the United States today. For the Christian church to say, down with all savings and loans, no private property, what have you. The assumptions behind them, however, of sufficiency, of the danger of things accumulating in the hands of fewer and fewer people, I think, are still assumptions by which we should do our economics and by which we live out some of our social ethics. Okay. By the way, I just want to give an aside. Sojourners is one of my favorite reading, one of my favorite magazines. If you've been to Holden, you'll know that that's true. I also like the Wittenberg Door that makes fun of everybody, and that's good, including Sojourners, and I hope the Sojourners staff loved it. If they didn't, I'm really disappointed. Wittenberg Door had an issue of So Boring. And it even looked like Sojourners. Anyway, I want you to know that on the back sheet of So Boring, there was a thing that you sent in in order to be an instant radical Christian. It was an instant kit, and for your dollars and something, you got, first of all, you got a Bible covered with Levi denim, and it guaranteed that when you dropped it, it opened up at Leviticus 25. And included in the kit was John Howard Yoder's private unlisted home telephone number. Anyway, you will find that in the groupings of Christians, and if they are grouped, I guess I'm over there with some of the Sojourners people, in a grouping of Christians, you will find a lot of reference to Jubilee Year and to some of the things that we're talking about. And it can be overdone, and that group can be pompous, and, you know, if there's a holier-than-thou attitude, there also can be a simpler-than-thou attitude. I'm aware of that. But in the midst of that, it seems to me that some of this biblical material does make a kind of pattern of some assumption. I use the word paradigm. Paradigm, I think the preferred pronunciation is paradigm. If there is one paradigm in the Old Testament, probably clearer than any other, it's the manna story. What were the instructions when there was to be manna? If you need more, take more. If you don't need so much, take less. In other words, take as much as you need, and it'll be provided every morning. And when they looked back and kind of analyzed what had happened, those who took less did not have too little, and those who took more did not have too much, except those who wanted to save some, who didn't trust the daily gift of manna. They took more than they needed, not more because they needed. They took more than they needed. They were the only ones in trouble. Why? It spoiled, and the stink rose to heaven. John V. Taylor, in his book Enough is Enough, has a whole chapter on the kind of biblical material that we're doing here, and five other excellent chapters on these issues. He says, that's what you smell. It's the stench rising from our excess. It's the curse on those with insatiable appetites who have taken more than enough, who now have the misery of more than enough. Okay. New Testament. There's lots of sections there too. If you think of the Sermon on the Mount, one day at a time, food, clothing, enough that you need, instead of laying up in store, it's an attitude of trust. Or 2 Corinthians 8, 13 through 15, in Paul's invitation for the churches to share, in Paul's stewardship plan for the early Christian church, what does he do? He goes back to the manna story as the paradigm and says, as a matter of equality, your abundance at the present time should supply their want, so that their abundance may supply your want, that there may be equality. As it is said, those who needed little took little, and those who needed much took more. He uses the manna story in the Old Testament in an appeal to part of the early Christian church to send an offering to another part of the early Christian church that was suffering. In other words, he used the think with as a way to undergird an early stewardship drive in the early Christian church. One more reference, and then we're going to do some discussing or some applying of this material. Philippians 4, 4 and 5. Let me start quoting it, and you fill in the blank. Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice. Let your moderation or, yeah, let your be known to all people. Another translation of the word moderation. Moderation is the word most people know. Forbearance is another one, depending upon the King James Version or the RSV. Moderation is not a good, strong, lively word, I don't think, in the United States. What does it mean if you say he or she is a moderate? Wishy-washy, in between. Not an extremist, okay. We've had people here from England, and there I think it's a much stronger word. Moderation is a very good word. The Greek epikesis, I think, could best be, if not translated, put in context by saying, let your fitting in be seen by all people. Let your toning into things be seen by all people. If the witness of the Christian church today was to fit in better in regard to the world's goods and our understanding of sufficiency and taking what we need, not what we are able to take, I think we would be living with a similar think with or a similar assumption that is very much part of the biblical material. Okay, I want to give you two illustrations and then open it up for discussion. We've still got 22 minutes. The two things I'm about to read obviously come with different think withs. First is Christopher Stendahl, Harvard Divinity School. As I see it, waves of fear and resentment will surge over the United States and the Western world in the years ahead. These will come when we are forced to shrink in our own self-importance, in our consumption of resources, and perhaps in our standard of living compared to the rest of the world. This suggests to me something that is most difficult, that is the most difficult thing spiritually, namely, for us to learn to diminish instead of always striving to be bigger and bigger. Our spiritual needs will be enormous when we try to overcome this ingrown way of thinking. That kind of grace, the grace to diminish, is the hardest of all to learn, but it would be very strange indeed if the church did not help us in this respect. But I fear that many people in America grab onto religion only as a way of making America stronger and bigger. This is common because of the strong fear that America might go backward. I hope and pray that the gospel, which has had power to overcome similar ways of thinking in the past, will do so again. Christopher Stendahl looks at the next several decades. One of the theme books for Holden this summer is the Global 2000 Report, official report asked for by President Carter, done by all of the agencies of the United States in charge of particular parts of environmental, population, natural resources. It says as we look down the next several decades, we will have to diminish for the sake of the sustainable society in this globe. We cannot continue the pace of growth and consumption and pollution and use of natural resources and the cutting of trees and the erosion of soil, all of those issues. Am I going too fast?
A little fast.
Okay. You just punch me.
We're okay.
We'll have to learn to diminish. Christopher Stendahl says, the church, with a biblical understanding, which is part of our heritage of understanding sufficiency, should be able to contribute to that. But what he sees is people have joined the church for exactly the opposite reason. That we have given an understanding of bigger is better, instead of giving an understanding, because of our faith, of small is beautiful. But his think with is sufficiency. Now, one of my favorites. Isn't she lovely? I'll quote. She's talking. Everything in moderation is about the dullest philosophy I have ever heard. Without any question, I work too hard, at least 9 hours a day, sometimes 10. I definitely care too much for Lionel, my husband. Doesn't he have a crazy name? Get this, women. Lionel is my reward at the end of the day for working too hard. I cook too passionately. Whatever that means. I play tennis to win. And on my last birthday, I ate 40 Blue Point oysters. My favorite magazine says, don't worry about too much, as long as too much makes you feel utterly fulfilled, utterly utilized, utterly happy. I love that magazine. I guess you could say I'm the cosmopolitan girl. Cosmopolitan magazine, the Hearst Corporation, paid for a full-page ad in Time magazine to advertise their magazine as the one that tells you to be utterly fulfilled and calls into question moderation as the dullest thing they've ever heard of. There's a think with behind that, isn't there? I mean, I picked one that, I don't care who you are, if you miss that one, we're in real trouble. I don't fear that one. I fear the ones much more subtle. I fear the ones where we as pastors give you the idea that it pays to be a Christian. Because we don't see Cosmopolitan magazine and heresy when it's a little more shielded and religious sounding and pious. But if we're biblical people, seems to me, grounded in the Word, we'll be able to sense when it's not the invitation of what Jesus meant by abundant life or what God's Word really promises, but is being pressured by the culture as to what the good life is. The Scriptures talk about the good life. I'm absolutely convinced of that. But I do think it's counter to much of what we have grown accustomed in our culture to equate with the good life. So if we're going to be biblical people, it's important to have that. Okay, let's have some questions and discussion. If you want more on it, we do have the book in the bookstore, and I think you'll find that the Anglican bishop writes clearly and refreshingly, even has the practical chapters on the cheerful revolution, on how you live this out in your home and how you eat and how you raise your kids. And it's a good book, but let's have some discussion for the last 20 minutes. Yes?
When I was asking you how this problem was, is where do I make the line at where enough is enough?
Okay. Does somebody want to say, I'm sure we all share the problem. Where do you make the line, or how do you go about making the line of what's enough and what's more than enough? Do you have suggestions?
Comfort
is the line.
I think so many of them. I hear so many people complaining about moving, about somebody bloodstream dressing or some mortar floor, and they come over to suffocate. Myself, I stop even when I'm full. And I think it's a matter of personal comfort.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Where do I set my comfort? Like in a car, do I set it with a Datsun or a Rolls Royce?
Okay.
It's on your pocketbook.
Just go ahead.
Comfort for some people could be a swimming pool because it's hot and central air conditioning, you know, and necessity or like just measure comfort measure.
Okay. So are you going to tell the other person where the line is? Or are you going to have other factors for yourself besides comfort? Factors like the global justice issue, brothers and sisters who don't even have the Datsun, or in other words, it sounds to me like you're going to have more than personal comfort. But one of the things to start with is there is a line at which too much is not even good for your health. So that there are legitimate things. I think what we're going to find is there are probably lots of factors, but let's just continue to name some. Yes?
Well, go back to the manna. You said that the ones who needed more took more.
Yes,
it wasn't
correct.
They may have scrutinized each other, but if you felt you needed more, you took more, and you used it fine. And it was a personal family unit kind of guidelines. And what's right for me and what I feel like maybe I think it's sufficient for me. Maybe it's not sufficient for you, or it's much too much for somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think so we can't judge other people for sufficiency.
Okay. What other factors would go into it for you besides feeling full? Are there other factors?
I see a problem if you use the suggestion of global justice.
Okay.
So if you're going to begin to kind of use your mind's eye about, well, the poor that they don't have any thought, you're not going to have any basis for any kind of problem. You're not questioning the Rolls Royce or a Datsun.
So?
So I just think that there's a problem with that as a criteria.
If for you there may be.
Yeah.
For others, that may be the final freedom.
Because
when the...
elusive way, just like the other.
Well, when the real crunch comes, I'm still happy that some Mennonite friends in Harrisonburg have their horse and buggy, and in some ways they're freer than the Dotson owners.
You see, even that. I can imagine some places that don't even have a horse and buggy.
Okay. Do you make some decisions on how much you have? What factors came into it, Oscar?
I have to deal with it in terms of myself, not dealing with it in terms of what somebody else is. I always had my mother talking about the poor Chinese, starving Chinese. That's no criteria. I had to deal with it in terms of my own life.
I think of this full group, there's an awful lot of figures like this.
Okay. Let me give you a different. Go ahead.
Well, it is a criteria because if we don't understand that we are eating 10 times as much protein as we need, that we don't look at how other people survive or learn about. If we don't, if we're not even interested in learning how other people eat and how come they don't eat the kind of meat we do, and people don't start trying to say, not being very clear that. We need to look at other comparisons because we can learn from them and maybe we can obtain a better world than what we need. And the comparison would not
immobilize you, because there are some in the world who will not who do not have anything. So as long as those are in the factoring, you will always be kind of guilty with what you have, or does it not do that to you?
I think we need to seriously consider overeating and overweight and other things. Yes,
okay, we got about six hands. Darius, I saw first.
Virginia
has a question. I didn't see that. Go ahead.
She said, you know, I think we need self-satisfied with what I have, and I also receive a lot of help, you know.
Evidently there's somebody at Sam's who's really doing the drawings that have been done by the month. There's several people that she paints with the paintbrush in her mouth. And, you know, there's quite a few places you can choose to send some different ones and share, you know, and divide up.
And there's always plenty left, you know, to get along with. Even though I'm getting on Social Security, it seems like there is enough. And a cap.
Eight caps around the neighborhood.
Thank you. Derek.
I'm a consumer-holic.
A consumer-holic?
Yeah.
All right.
And like people who have problems with alcoholism, I think I need a consumer's anonymous group for, you know, every time I feel the urge to buy, to call them up. When Dan and Karen were meeting in Albuquerque, we somewhat did it. And for whatever reason I said I wanted it, they would try to talk me out of why I really wanted it and if I really needed it or not. I think we need a community, and maybe the church can be that type of community or family people to really just say, you know, Rolls Royce, you know that's ridiculous. But now, okay, you're talking about Dotson. Now, why do you need that car? Is that a second one? Or, you know, keep pushing. Let you make up your own mind, you know, but push hard those questions to see what level is enough. And I'm always agonizing over that.
Should it be a point at which we're always agonizing? Is that a denial of God as the giver of every good and perfect gift and celebrating life? Is it always going to be a kind of agony?
I think so, as far as who we are as Americans. For me, it will be always agonizing.
Okay. For you, it will. I think for others, they want it to be something else. Up there, and, well, there's three up there. First, yeah, go ahead.
I just, to that, I just recalled something that Mother Teresa said, something to the effect that it's not the miracle isn't that we're doing this, but that it's the joy that we do it. And I think that to give up things doesn't have to be an agony, but with God's grace, it can be a joy to be giving things up and just keep going along with life.
But see, I'm still possessed with the disease of that consumer holic. I haven't been liberated yet.
I think Elmer Witt does four sessions on St. Francis this week to really see whether it's, if I understand correctly the topics, what did it mean to celebrate a kind of radical poverty? Maybe that'll continue this discussion. Yes.
I guess I want to express a further question. What happens at, like someone was saying down there about how it was important to just consider people that are poorer than us, you know, talking about somebody that's just absolutely barely even enough to eat, doesn't have any possessions, and what do I do when I consider that, then what? You know, I guess I'm just an absolutist. I don't like to say, well, this part is okay, and I just don't know where to draw that line, you know.
So you're agreeing with Oscar, are you agreeing with Oscar that when you bring that factor in, it is not helpful because it just makes all other decisions difficult?
Well, it's something I want to consider, but I can't feel comfortable with it. I don't know where to go with it.
I get you.
Well, I need that. I mean, I like, I'm not preaching, like, but I need to look at the global perspective. That's when I decide what I really need. Because if I look only at my neighbors or all of us, then I need much more. And so it helps me balance things. And I have to be careful not to use what I need to be comfortable. I don't need that much, but it just helps to really define what I need. And then it seems ridiculous to pick up that because it doesn't seem like I'm helping anything. And maybe I could use them and that's a big deal. But somehow it's a cutback that I wouldn't really have enough to give you consideration.
There's two or three good factors in what she just said. Some people will not make any move on lifestyle changes unless they see a direct cause and effect. I won't cut down unless I see that I'm saving the world by doing it. Or I won't stop fertilizing my lawn unless that bag of Scott's lawn feed gets to Bangladesh and I know who gets it. I'm exaggerating. I don't think you can ever see those cause and effect relationships between what will always be simple lifestyle changes, a little less beef, a little that, and a tremendous number of world problems. But there is a connection between my lifestyle and the world's needs. There is a part of the world's problems is an accumulation of small steps over the last 20 or 30 years especially, at no point in which did we think we were causing the problem. Just a small thing. Part of the solution is small steps. At no point will we think we're solving the world, but an accumulation of small steps the other way in 20 or 30 years would be part of the problem. Another is my own integrity. Not that I'm saving the world, but it's just that I feel it's a more faithful way to live. It's literally better for my health, for my spirit, and for my body to live differently. So there's lots of things. David.
Yeah, I think it's going to hit us like a lead brick about 20 years down the line when we just run out of fossil fuels and people realize, hey, I've got to change now because I have my first in the world to explain that way. We're running out of resources. And I think it goes much deeper than that. Well, it does have to be a conscious decision, you know, and it's real hard to see the little changes you do, how it affects the world. But it's like it's going to happen. We're going to have to change. And if people don't start to do that and realize the grace is going to hit them, oh wow, I got to change it.
Okay, thank you. There were some other hands up. Sandy? And then, yeah, okay.
Something that I think is helpful, and I am not a good example in terms of simple living, Well, that does help me to just talk to myself, to have a conversation about, I really don't need it. And some days I really do need a chocolate bar, but some days I convince myself real well that I really don't need it, or that I can walk somewhere. And it's just daily, little decisions that finally make you have a lifestyle that changes. But psychologically, we can change the way we feel about things by talking to ourselves. They do it with biofeedback with pain, and we can do it in terms of how much we need.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
I'm a card-carrying member of Toolaholics.
How do you do in a hardware store?
I call friends. But somehow we have to learn to ask that second question.
All right.
Do I really need it? Why do I need it? Is somebody selling me a line? And I think so much of our society does sell us a line.
Okay.
And we buy it. In that sense, this comparison business does have a negative effect. Where I look at my neighbor, he has another car, or he has a new lawnmower, that type of thing, and I continue to buy the ones that I gotta have it too, and it's so subtle. And so we gotta learn to answer that second question.
Yeah, okay. One of the frustrations of an hour on this topic is Mary and I have usually had a weekend retreat when we take this topic. One of the things that I developed was a list of columns, enough, just right, feel good about it, is satisfying. Second column, too much, more than enough, would become a burden. And we went down, I guess we had 20 things, including how much money a year, the temperature in a room, a number of cups of coffee a day. At a certain point, I feel deprived because I like coffee. I know when it's too much. I mean, it's just more than I needed. And to do that kind of exercise and to realize that sometimes too much is a burden. Sid Simon, who does the books on value clarification, finally came down. He just did it one day. 4 shirts is enough. After that, he was trying to get new drawers to store them in and a closet, and he spent too much time figuring out which one to wear, so it's 4. Now, I think I'd like a few more than that. The point was, for him, that was the point of the most freedom. So when he gets a new shirt, which he enjoys once in a while, either buying one or getting one as a gift, he gives one of the other ones away. That's the thing we don't do. We deaccumulate about once every 5 years, don't we? And it takes about one more year to have all of that junk. We don't get that point at which too much is a burden. Store it, move it, insure it, worry about it. There's a point at which it's too much. One other point of freedom, and then we're almost at coffee break. I have a pastor friend. He and his wife determined what was enough in the way of yearly salary for them to live. He's one of the people that I know in the ALC who I would say live very simply, and they live a very full life, but they do not have many material needs. When they determined what was enough, they looked at the salary scale that the ALC can provide. They were below the lowest salary of 5,000 or whatever congregations we have. What did that do? It opened up the possibility of their moving anywhere to any parish. Really did. If they had needed $40,000 a year, I guarantee you the movement within the ALC clergy is very limited. It opened up, there are times when your needs being low opens up opportunities that you cut yourself out of when you have to have such and such in order to be full. There really are some benefits to having your needs very simply. I think most people consider a vacation living closer to the earth, being closer to their family, wearing simpler, older clothes, having very simple kind of recreation, eating out or cooking over a fire or not being fancy, and then we feel ripped off that there's a few hippies who have found a way to live that way all year long. Don't you see, there are some people who take what you consider to be your refreshing weekend vacation values and have just said, if those are values, maybe that's the way God wanted us to live. And they have freed up themselves from some of those pressures that are part of this system. So don't, that doesn't answer Oscar's question, doesn't answer a few of the things going on. But just, if there's one thing that I'm trying to say, it's that it seems to me too much of the lifestyle changes that are coming, that are being promoted, have the idea that anything that is cutting down from our present lifestyle must be deprivation and therefore will end in great unhappiness. I don't believe that's true. I believe that some of the things that are being called for, if we understood that small is beautiful, and that sometimes we will be freer without so much stuff, some of the changes that are coming, we will be able to move into creatively and maybe be healthier because of it. Not all of the changes that are coming, but at least some of them that are coming, I think, are because part of the present lifestyle, which is convenient, also means we're not as creative as we were meant to be. We're not as innovative as some other ideas of simplicity cause us to be, and there's a kind of fulfillment in coming up with new ways to do it. The couple that was traveling and knew that all the motels were closed, they realized that, they knew they didn't have a place to sleep, and they stopped at the farm. They happened to pick a good Mennonite farmer and his wife, and they said, could we stay here tonight? They said, sure. Fine, glad to have you, no problem. Go out in the barn, there's hay in the loft. You'll sleep well, the hay is fresh, smells good, and if there's anything you need, anything at all, just come and we'll tell you how you can get along without it for one night.